Missouri. It's the 19th most populous state in America, and it boasts more than 6 million residents. But hidden within its nearly 70,000 square miles is an area known as Marley Woods, but its exact location remains a total mystery. Ripe with paranormal activity, it rivals that of the more recognized Utah location known as Skinwalker Ranch. Though Marley Woods, unlike the Utah location which turned into a History Channel television series, has stayed away from the TV cameras and any widespread notoriety. Ted Phillips, a pioneering legend within the UFO field, spearheaded the research into this mysterious location. Although now passed away, his protege and my guest today, Thomas Ferrario, continues the hunt for the truth. He's here to step into the vault and explain some of the darkest, deepest, and most frightening experiences that he and others have encountered while there. And some of those experiences may have even left a lasting physical effect that will be with him for the rest of his life. Stay tuned. You're about to take a wild ride inside the Black Vault. That's right, everybody. As always, thank you so much for tuning in and making this your podcast or your live stream of choice. I'm your host, John Greenwald Jr., founder and creator of theblackvault.com. And today is going to be an exciting show because I get to explore a topic that I've known about for a long time due to my friendship and relationship with the late Ted Phillips, but also my friendship with my guest today, Tom Ferrario, who was one of the main researchers that worked with Ted. On his work on what's called Marley Woods. Now, we'll get to that in a minute. But Tom, thank you so much for joining the show.
Oh, thank you, John. It's good to be back with you again. And we did all have a connection there for a while, and we worked together. And it's good to be here. And, of course, it's good to be anywhere right now, I tell you.
Yes, it certainly is. Well, I've been wanting to do a show with you for a long time. You and I have known each other for many, many, many years, and I've respected you guys, not only you, but the team that you work with, simply because you go for the science, the nuts and bolts, the evidence, and you really just kind of dig in. You're not in it for the glitz and glamour, and that has always stuck with me over the years, and I've always appreciated that about you. Let me get you to give my audience a little bit of background. How did you get into UFO research, paranormal research, and why?
I actually started in personal experiences, and I live in a rural community. And through my experiences and people reaching out to me, and in a small community, it is taken very seriously. People do not go around talking about ufology, UFOs, what they've seen or experienced. And when you get to be a trusted individual in that community, let me tell you, there's a lot more experiences nationwide than you can imagine. And then I talked on a Sunday afternoon. I did a call to MUFON and contacted Walt Andrus, which at that time was in St. Louis, one of the co-founders of MUFON. And I spoke with him 2 hours on the phone. And through my speaking with him, he thought I should be in the MUFON, should get some training, and he assigned me to get some training and connected me with Bruce Whitteman, a very great individual, was state director for MUFON in Missouri for many years, and I know you know Bruce well.
I have.
But Walt actually made me a section director on the phone, and when I contacted Bruce the first time, Bruce actually said, well, first of all, I don't know who you are, and you're not even in MUFON. You can't be a section director. So I said, well, Walt Andrews assigned me. And so Bruce called him and we had a meeting, the three of us, and got me some training. He assigned me with a gentleman named Jim Cross, which was an Air Force captain in St. Louis, which I went out on cases with him. And Jim was a very nuts and bolts man also. He was a photographic analyst also and a jet pilot. And I learned quite a bit working with Jim and then with Bruce, of course. But that's my background. And then that went into working with Bruce on conferences. And I will tell you, from the first lecture I heard Ted Phillips spoke at, I was just amazed and blown away by the man. And my dream was always to work with him. So I would send him letters, and I finally got to meet him at one conference that we were working. And I offered my services to Ted. And I was an electrician and worked as an electrical engineer for some powerboat companies along the way. And Ted said, well, he said, if you're serious about it, let's see what you got. And so that's how we met. Our first relationship was that, a practical one. I did the wiring, ran wires and put cameras at Marley Woods up on windmills and alike. And then we got to be over the years close friends. And that's how my relationship with Ted started and how I got introduced to Marley Woods.
Before we get into Marley Woods, a quick background on Ted Phillips for those who aren't aware. He recently passed away, or I say recently, it's been, what, a year or two maybe?
Yeah, it was on March the 10th of last year we lost Ted.
So about a year and a half.
I'll tell you, it was a big loss, and the time's gone so fast. And we had scheduled some memorials for him near his home and in Branson, Missouri. And we had a big hall rented, and several people were going to come. And Jock Vallee had made a video, and because of the darn virus, it just never happened. And we do have a video we're putting together right now. It should be out. It'll air recently. I believe within the next couple months, we'll have it out, and I'll give you the details on that one when it's out there. He was just an incredible man. Like you said, a nuts and bolts man. And, you know, Ted's passion in ufology started when he was a young boy. You know, his father worked at a radio station and got him an interview with two Air Force captains, that bomber pilots from World War II that had, of course, the typical Foo Fighter sightings. And I mean, close proximity to their plane, within 20 foot of their cockpit, these pilots had. And as Ted said, it didn't get any better speaking with anyone than Air Force pilots. So that increased the passion in Ted. And he was very much a nuts and bolts man. As you said, he went to work with on a case actually in Missouri. People think Ted's first case was the Lonnie Zamora's case in Socorro, but actually Alan got with Ted on a case in Missouri, which was a very monumental case, which we're working up the background on that and going to get that out. We feel it's as groundbreaking as Lonnie Zamora case that's never been dealt with.
And let me interject real quick. You said Alan, just for those who aren't aware, you're talking about Dr. J. Alan Hynek of the Project
Yes, I am.
Fame and so on. And, yes. And Ted Phillips, again, for those who aren't aware, had worked under Dr. J. Alan Hynek, which is how he started. And I had produced a documentary for History Channel where we explored Ted's origin story and tying back into Dr. J. Alan Hynek. It is an amazing, amazing story about how they came together and worked together. And so many years later, how much Ted really did and continued the hard work that obviously was pioneered by who trained him, essentially, which was Dr. J. Alan Hynek. So amazing history there. And I appreciate your background. And I want to segue into now Marley Woods, simply because you've brought it up a couple times. And also, this is, I would say, a great time to explore it, because everybody in the UFO field, and even outside of the UFO community as a core, now we see Skinwalker Ranch as a History Channel documentary. You know, they're out there with television cameras. And in my opinion, anyway, they give the impression that's just this unique, one-of-a-kind area. But Marley Woods sounds like it is very much in comparison to something like Skinwalker Ranch, where you have all sorts of activity. So let me throw it to you, Tom. What is Marley Woods, and what goes on there?
Marley Woods is, you know, we used to think they were, these places were more unique. I will tell you that there are several across the globe, not to the intensity, though, I will say, as Skinwalker and Marley Woods. You know, Marley Woods isn't, and I will go off, just tell you, Marley Woods is a fictitious name that Ted originally put together, because we owe it to the property owners. They asked us, don't go looking on a map for Marley Woods. It is totally fictitious name, to protect the participants in the ranch and the, everything that goes on there, because we had a little security issues in the beginning, and it doesn't get pretty, but it's an area that encompasses 2 miles east and west and 3 miles north and south. Now, it's comprised of two ranches that one is 1,200 acres and one's approaching 1,000 acres, with two property owners that we work with that trust us complicitly. And it is a place of high strangeness, and this goes back several generations, I will tell you. We've tried to track it, even going back to Native American culture. We have not been able to. We just recently found Native American, which we thought there wasn't any proof of them being in this area. And we just recently found some elements that showed us that there had been a presence, Native American presence, on one of the sites with a natural spring in it. But it's an area that I will tell you, it has the high strangeness. Everything you've seen on Skinwalker, I would tell you that we have that and much more. We have the unseen force, and I just list these briefly: light ball activity, cryptid activity, which includes large white animals, beasts, cryptids, flying reptilian things, and it goes into cattle mutilations, energy sources, which is very much similar to what they're dealing with right now in Skinwalker. We dealt with, we did narrow it down, I will tell you, to the energy levels, and I am able to tell you right now that for a short time we did have a tie with the Bigelow Foundation. We worked with Cone Keller, and we had several of their people with us we worked with. And our energy, so we did narrow it down to in the microwave spectrum. We felt that most of our problems with the energy sources, it led us to the, and this I must say with Ted, everything is documented and done. If you can't prove it scientifically, you don't even mention it. And there were a lot of things we didn't mention that went on that later on that we wish we would have mentioned, but that was Ted's method. And he was for the scientific approach and method, and that's what we had to do.
Can I ask you really quick to timestamp when you guys were there with Bigelow's funding or Comb Kelleher's involvement? When was that?
That was back, I would say, in the 2008-2009 period. And it was, you know, we had a relationship. They'd spend time with us, and they wanted us to come out and spend time with them at Skinwalker. We never had the time or the ability because we were a small team, and quite frankly, we had things just exploding off the chart at that period at Marley that we were dealing with. But Ted and I and the team, Adam Johnson, and a gal that's a state director now, which I call her my sister, we're very close. She's the state director for MUFON now, Debbie Ziegelmeyer. Debbie, I know you know Debbie.
Say, Debbie, yeah.
And she's been on a lot of productions lately, of late, in the Alaskan Triangle. But we were running our tails off out there at times, and we spent a lot of time out there. Ted and our group, besides the lecture circuit and Marley Woods, I was away from home more than I was at home, I'll tell you. And but the high strangeness of this area, it went off the scales at times. And I will tell you, whenever you'd like me to get into it, there was a downside that Ted didn't like to speak of very much. It was the physical effects encountered by the team and some of us.
Yeah.
Ted didn't like the researchers to be part of the research ever.
Yeah.
So, and he didn't want to upset the ranchers, the property owners.
I do want to get into that. I want to ask you one thing.
Yes.
I'm not sure if you can answer, so I'll apologize in advance. When you had, and the reason why I'm asking about the Bigelow connection, which was intriguing to me in the year, that was during the funding years that the Defense Intelligence Agency was giving money to Bigelow in a program called OSAP. And so the question I have for you is, around that time frame, was it ever bantered about that this was part of potentially a government research program?
You know, believe me, we have had that question posed to us many times. We didn't see any signs of that. And I will tell you that through the years, Ted, of course, working with Hynek and Project Blue Book in the last stages, and we did deal in the early days. There was that connection that when Ted parted with that area, with the government connection, he was very cautious. He didn't want to associate or touch base with that culture at all in any way, shape, or form. So I know a lot of people thought that we never dealt with that in Marley. A lot of people had asked us, did we think the government was monitoring us in Marley and had any way, shape, or form interjected things in our Ted's research? And I can tell you, quite frankly, I don't believe they did. And, you know, what the Bigelow aspect of it, we believe they were very honest with us, and we worked quite well for a while together. And Cone Keller worked with us, and we enjoyed it. And it just didn't turn out to be a mutual agreement as we thought it would be. But it was a control issue there, a property I'll just throw out there. And we really detected no government involvement at that time with any parties.
Gotcha. Well, I appreciate you fielding the question. So let's get into the evidence aspect of it. Again, I know that you and Ted were both convinced that something was going on out there. Can you potentially answer for Ted as well? But for you, what convinced you that there was something going on at Marley Woods that made you guys say, okay, we really need to investigate this?
What convinced me in the early stages that, as Ted heard from the very beginning, Ted told me that out of all his years of doing the nut and bolt research, he had never actually experienced anything physically. And Marley was the first time he had actually seen any UFOs or anything. And it goes so much beyond the scene of a UFO or structured craft, or mainly what we experienced were light balls at Marley. Once in a while, there were structured crafts involved. But it was the intelligence aspect of it that we dealt with on an almost daily basis that was always one step ahead of us. It read our weakest moments. It read when we were the least prepared to capture something on video or audio. And when we were prepared to capture something and we started experiencing things, it would literally take out our equipment sometimes. It would burn out circuitry. it would eject. And I'll date myself here. We were using VHS tapes. We had a large raft of VHS tapes in the office. And I just want to throw out the property owners in Marley were so great. They built Ted a two-level structure with a big observation deck for Ted to stay in and to have an office in and to work out of in Marley. Wow. And later they built us an outside open observation deck. But this entity, this intelligence it wiped VHS tapes clean in one instance, ejected tapes from the machine. When we switched to DVRs, it would burn out some of our DVRs that had multi-hour, hundreds of hours of storage in them. And it always had the upper hand. Now, one of the things I will tell you that we just recently did a video with Jacques Vallée, which Jacques came out and spent time with us. There was an incident that happened with him that really turned him around. And it was just briefly, I'll go into that. The incident that happened was in the cabin that Douglas Trumbull donated us. And he was actually there at this point with us, and Jacques Vallée was there. We set the camera on a table and a window facing north to capture what we call the North Mystery Light. And we locked the doors to the cabin. And the next morning when we went in, the camera was turned 90 degrees away from the window on a locked tripod. And at first, Douglas was very agitated at this. He said, "Who's messing with us?" And we said, "No one was in this cabin, Doug." So then Jacques really picked up on that. And Jacques spoke about this a couple times in a lecture he actually gave, that this phenomena actually, and that's the way this would play with us. It would always show its upper hand. And we were dealing with an intelligence, we felt. And then I was going into that. Ted warned me in the beginning of how this at times could affect you. Like even when we weren't in the field and we slept in some mornings, and 3 a.m. is the bewitching hour, I'll tell you, not 12 a.m. like so many people think. And you learn that fast in ufology. More things happen at 3 a.m. than at midnight. But I woke up one morning and Ted was sleeping in another bed across from me in the upper level of the office. And I felt like something shook me, woke me up physically. And I woke up with an overwhelming sense of joy. And I don't know why to this day, I ran out on the deck expecting to see the mothership or something. I just knew something was there. And there was absolutely nothing. And my state of joy went to almost depression. And I went in and woke Ted up, which is something you really never wanted to do. And I told Ted what had happened. And he rolled over and looked at me. And he said, "Well, Tom, welcome to Marley Woods." So that was one of my first experiences in Marley. And but it's a very real presence.
Before we get into the physical effects, because I want you to talk about that, let me ask you just a quick question. Because as you describe these experiences, a lot of people will hear UFOs and lean towards alien. I keep hearing more of a spirit / ghost kind of presence, depending upon your belief sets in that. But that's what I keep feeling from you as you explain these stories. Did you guys have a consensus of what type of intelligence you were dealing with?
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you asked that point. And I will tell you, and now this is going to step on the toes. I know of a lot of ufologists that want to think interplanetary, but I can speak from Ted Phillips's, his experiences with Dr. J. Allen Hynek, came to believe this and totally proved it. Ted's belief was this. Jacques Vallée 100%. Jacques was on board with this before almost anybody and believes this 100%. And what they believe is, and we all come to believe, and we actually documented and proved to our satisfaction, this is all, in Jacques' words, it's frequency driven. Now, in layman's terms, that means dimensionally based. And what that says is, this is all dimensionally based. It's all dimensional. We feel there are portals out in Marley, as all these other places, such as Skinwalker. Things come through physically. We believe we caught one-on-one image doing this. When they're on your side, there is real physical. They leave, as Ted said, physical, tangible tracks, physical trace cases. When they're not here, you can search the woods with 1,000 men, and it's gone. The phenomenon's gone. Now, we proved that on so many levels in Marley, and they're touching on this a lot at Skinwalker now. But I will tell you that they, and if I have to put my money on anybody, I'm sorry. I know a lot of ufologists don't want to believe this and don't want to go in this realm, but personally, I'll put my money on Dr. J. Allen Hynek, Ted Phillips, Jacques Vallée, and there are others. Ray Stanford, a good friend of mine, is another one. Douglas Trumbull. So I just believe that's truly what we're dealing with here.
And if it wasn't, you know, Ted leading the way and you and me knowing you, I usually dismiss stories like this, to be honest with you, just simply because it seems a little bit far-fetched. But in the same respect, like I said, you guys are you. And I've known you guys for years, which is the, intriguing part of all of this. So let's get into the physical effect aspect. You've mentioned it a couple times. I want you to go into a little bit more detail here. You guys,
yes.
And gals, I'm not sure if Debbie came with you. I assume she might have. But team of researchers, small team, goes out there. You guys experience some stuff. What was happening to you?
Well, I'm going to touch in. I just want to go back just briefly quick and just say that, as you stated too, John, in the beginning, I had very much problem. I wanted to deal with a structured craft like Ted did. And I will tell you a little known fact is that Ted did have an outing with Dr. J. Allen Hynek for a short time. They became great friends again, worked with each other up to the point of Dr. J. Allen Hynek's passing. They had spoken, worked together a week before Dr. Hynek's passing. Ted was very much against Dr. J. Allen Hynek's theory on this. Ted was a nuts and bolts man. He wanted to go there. That's what he wanted to do. And he didn't want to accept this. But over the years, and especially at Marley, he said that Allen was so far ahead of his time. And like Allen said, this is so much more than a structured craft and a little green guy coming here from Alpha Centauri. It's so much more involved and more than what that is. That's so simplistic that that's not what's going on at all. So I just wanted to lay out there that was hard for Ted to accept. It was hard for me to accept, believe me, but it's real. And you got to go where the data leads you and what you experience. And that's what we felt. Now, getting into the physical attributes of this, what we experienced, you know, we can get into the realm on the animal. We had cattle mutilations in Marley, and I'm telling you, Ted's first cattle mutilation, before I was involved with him, he was called out there, and he seen the cattle mutilate, typical, you know, defleshed, the face of skull, sexual organs taken, no blood, that same scenario. He came up on the rancher, showed him the first one, and Ted asked, how often does this go on in Marley? And the rancher said, well, come with me, Ted. And they walked behind the barn, and here the rancher had a stack of bleach white bones about a 25-foot in diameter pile about 12 foot high behind one old barn of what he claims to have been all due to cattle mutilation. And the reason it was just thrown in this manner was there was no predation. There was no predators, insect involved in most of these. Nothing would touch these carcasses. So that was absolutely a part of Marley, the physical effects. We can go through it. Just before I get into the human aspects of this, we had a case called the Horse Barn Incident, which Ted was called on a Saturday morning. We weren't out there at the time. The rancher said that you gotta get out here, Ted. And he said one of his prize horses had been affected by this. And we didn't get out there, unfortunately, for 6 weeks. And when we got out there, it affected the rancher so greatly. And just briefly what that was, the rancher had a habit of going from the house, walking the perimeter of his pastures, the checking the fence line. He had a barn where he had his favorite riding horse, his favorite horse in a corral. He always brought it some sugar in the morning. He dropped in and seen it. The horse was perfectly fine, ate the sugar, no problems. He closed the corral, went on his way checking the fence line. And now he was within sight of this barn the whole time. He was probably, I'd say a quarter mile away from the barn. He ran the fence line, came back up in front of the barn. And as he glanced over at the barn, he seen that the corral door was ajar. And he said, well, that's not right. I know I closed it. And what I will warn you, what follows is really gruesome. As he went in the corral, he describes as what he seen was a slaughterhouse in there, that he said that there was flesh and blood on the lower rafters of the barn, all the corral, the wooden corral boards, the sides, the gates, and virtually what had been in a matter of 20 minutes, a completely healthy horse had turned into a mass of horse flesh in this barn as such, it exploded. And we got out there, we took some sampling. There was no residual radiation of any type. We sent in what we had. And now I will tell you that the samples we took were several weeks old. So they weren't good sampling, but there was no chemical traces found in this. It was to the degree that an explosive device was put in this horse, but there was no residual of any type of explosives. And here again, thanks to Ted's experience in the field over the years, and another case he involved, and I'll touch upon that sometime with you, a case he involved in Vietnam when he was sent there, and Ted was sent all over the world for Alan Hynek when Alan had prior engagements and couldn't make it or health reasons. But Ted had come across this phenomena before, and what they had, after research, they determined it was. But it was as if this horse had been placed in a microwave oven and exploded. And there again, dealing with microwave, you have no residual radiation, or you better not have. Just like when you place a piece of meat in a microwave oven, there's not going to be anything residual on that piece of meat, or better not be. So that gets into the extreme cases of how this intelligence. Now, do we believe this thing set out to destroy this horse? We have no proof of that. Was it a residual effect of energy that it was exposed to for, whatever reason? We don't know that answer. But I will tell you that the area that this horse was in had been frequently, it's in the area too, some of the cattle mutilations were. So for what reason and how this occurred, we don't know. But Ted did draw the conclusion, and other people he sent this off to, and he spoke with some of his at the time some people that he had dealt with in the past, and they all felt that this was from microwave radiation, John.
Were there, I mean, not that I want to see them by the description, but did you guys take pictures? Did the homeowners take pictures? Were they shown to, and again, this is not a distrust for your research ability, but just like an outside third party, either, you know, university level, you know, analyst, scientist, whatever. Did that happen, or was this stuff just like nobody wanted to touch it, which is why you guys essentially took the lead?
When we got there, we took pictures. I have a picture of myself taking some sampling, kneeling down, scraping some of this off the floor. Of course, at that time, it was all dried material. Absolutely, which is odd, no smells like a decaying animal or blood, or you would expect there to be an odor there. Unusually, there was no odors there. And we did take pictures of myself sampling and Adam Johnson in the same barn taking samples. We have. There really wasn't a lot for us to catch on video or with photographs. Unfortunately, this affected the property owner to the degree. After this happened, he came down with a neighbor and they took the large parts out and burned them. He did not take any photographs, which the minute Ted told him about this, which he didn't even notify Ted for a week after this happened. He was so affected by this. And he did not take any photographs. And I will tell you that after we did the investigation and we did our sampling, Ted, we were going to return to that site below the rancher's house. He actually, this small wooden, it was an older barn. He actually was so affected by it, he burned the structure down. He couldn't look at it anymore. So he actually burned this barn down rather than deal with it. So there you have just what we found, what we took pictures. We wish to God he would have took some images, you know, of this or sampling at the time, but there was none of that done. So, And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to establish a full-time presence. At least one or two of us at Marley. When we were working with the Bigelow team, that was our goal, that we were going to get funding and be able to do that. But that never occurred. I will tell you that it's one of the more dramatic things that happened at Marley.
I would say that's a pretty dramatic and traumatic experience for all parties involved. Before we get into you know, more of the research that you guys did, I do want you to talk about, you had mentioned physical effects to you and or maybe the team. Can you talk about those types of effects as well?
Yes. And now this is an area, I will tell you, that Ted spoke to us. Of course, Ted gave us full discretion to speak about, do whatever we wanted. If it was contrary to his wishes or affected the team, believe me, we would have been out of there. But we went the way Ted, we felt what his wishes were, but he gave us, you know, the discrepancy to talk about it or deal with it. But he basically, there were things out there that happened and other aspects of Ted's life that Ted said, you know, Tom, after I'm gone, I don't give a damn what you do with this stuff, but I'd rather not, we don't focus on this, because Ted devoted so much of his life to Marley. He didn't want to take the focus away from the research in Marley and what was going on in Marley. And he felt that if we got too dramatic with what happened to the researchers or some of the other things that were the reasons why Ted spoke of and why he devoted the rest of his life in Marley, because of what he thought was going to occur in Marley, I'll tell you. He just didn't want to take the focus off that. So he said that, you know, he'd rather we just speak about this after he was gone and then those issues we dealt with, that it didn't take a focus away from the research on Marley itself, what was going on. And but anyway, I can get into the physical effects now if you'd like, John.
Please, yeah, I'd like to hear about that.
Okay, and what that mainly deals with is there's a phenomenon out at Marley, another thing we dealt with that the ranchers dealt with for years and years, far back as they can remember, and it was called the light beams. Now, what these light beams were, they were a pure, I don't want to compare them to a spotlight because that's not a fair, that's not apples. I mean, that's just not a fair comparison because what we experienced, and we heard this for several times, we've heard of this retold out there. And but what that encompasses was a pure white light beam sweeping the area as if hunting for something, like it was looking for something, searching for something, for whatever reason. And we heard of that phenomenon by the ranchers several times. The first time we experienced that personally, Adam Johnson and I, we were in a deer stand on a night. It was like 28 degrees. We were in the deer stand with cameras set up, monitoring devices, EMF equipment, analog, digital, the whole spectrum, trying to be ready for something. Absolutely nothing. And there again, this stuff reads your weakness. We decided to call it quits after 3.5 hours, and we had all our cameras we were putting away, which is a stupid thing to do out there. We were getting all our stuff in our backpacks to climb down, and I noticed over at Adam's side to the north, a light coming down, hitting the timber on a 6-acre field, sweeping across the timber, coming down into the pasture, and it came across the pasture right to the point our deer stand was on the opposite side of the field in the timber, right on the edge of the timber of that field. It swept across the field, went right to the bottom of our deer stand as if it was going to come up into it with us, and extinguished in an instant. Now, I was trying to see the source of this, and Adam was trying to get his cameras back out. Unfortunately, he got one up and running too late, and he didn't get any. It just switched off before he got his camera up. I was trying to see the source of the light, which I did not. I could not see. It just came out of the sky at that point. And so that's the first time we experienced that. And we were on radio with Ted and asked Ted if he'd seen this. And Ted was in another part of the property on another field on the timber with a property owner. They seen no artifact of this, what we were saying. They were saying, you know, it's impossible. We didn't see anything, which there again, this brings into play the dimensional aspect. This stuff is very dimensional. If you're not in the right place at the right time, you're not going to observe this or any artifacts of it. Now, there were no physical effects from that at that time. I was in that area with Adam. A second time it happened to Ted and I, and this is one of Ted's most, the very little shook Ted Phillips up, I will tell you, very little. This is one time that it shook him up to the point where he called his wife at home after it occurred and spoke with her. It's one of two instances that shook Ted at Marley that bad, but we were in my vehicle coming back on site two and this is a 1,200 acre ranch, I'll tell you, gated area. It's a dirt road off a gravel road in the middle of 1,200 acres that no one has access to or can get access to. So there's no way this, and no way this or possibility that this was done to us, but I happened to look in my rearview mirror and I seen the same light, a bright white, intense light coming up the road behind us. it came up behind us and onto the vehicle. And as it came in the back window of the vehicle, it lit up the interior of our vehicle to the degree where I remember seeing the vinyl grain in the dash and looking down the air vents in my vehicle to the furthermost point in what the dust in them. And I mean, it was just, I hate to draw the analogy again to Close Encounters in that scene, but that's what it was. And at that point, I told Ted, I said, "Are you seeing this, Ted?" And Ted looked over at me and he said, "Well, hell yes, I'm seeing this, Tom." And we both instinctively at that point, which is probably not a wise thing to do, we threw open the doors and jumped out of the vehicle and looked up. And what we seen at that point was, which I don't know how, I'm a little bit knowledgeable about lighting, and I have never seen in my life the effect I seen that night. And I don't know how you'd recreate it, but the light retracted from the vehicle with a cut off definite end. And it retracted into what Ted described as the aperture, you know, that twisting reflex of an old time camera, the way it twists. We've seen that light retract into that aperture. And when it closed, it was gone. I mean, there was no craft, there was no light ball, there was no remnant of that. It's just, it was there and it was gone. Now, that's what we experienced on that road. And we got back to site one where we stayed the structure, and we pulled up to the structure. Ted got out and he started taking his gear out of the car and to take up into the building. And I noticed he just dropped some of it on the ground, which was so unusual for Ted to do. I mean, he took care of equipment like he was meticulous, especially with cameras, since he was a professional photographer. But I said, "Ted, what's the matter?" And he was over leaning on the building at that point, and he was vomiting. And I was really worried about him, and because he had some other health issues. And I said, "Are you going to be okay, Ted?" And he said, "Well, I think so. I don't know." And he said, "Just let me stand here for a while." So he stood there for a while, leaning on the building, and finally he got upright. And he came over and grabbed his camera. I said, "I'll get your cameras for you. Just go up and lay down." So he went up and laid down that evening. And at that point, I was thinking, well, I didn't know if it was from what had happened or just Ted's health. And I thought, well, I'm glad. I said, in hindsight, I wish that would have happened to me. I said, well, I'm glad that didn't happen to me. So anyway, that was the end. And about a day later, we left. And the one thing I will tell you, we told the property owners what had occurred. We did not share with them the physical Ted getting sick or anything. We never wanted to worry them. And which in hindsight, I wish we would have shared everything with them. And I'll tell you why. We left that visit, that trip, and I came home. And about a week later, my scalp on my head, and at this point, I will say I had dark brown hair then. I got to wear a condition. My head just hurt all the time. I couldn't even touch my hair. It hurt so bad. So I went in, and this is all documented. I have the documentation. I went into my physician. He thought I had shingles at first. They did test. I didn't have shingles. He looked it over and he said, "Well, it looks like maybe you got sunburn or some type of burn." I was on strong opiates for a couple weeks just to deal with the pain of my scalp. And I thought that would be the extent of it or be the worst part of it. And within a month, my hair turned from dark brown to what you see today. Actually, it was actually got to be white after that. And to this day, it's the color you see. In the summer, it goes to white on top and usually light blonde. And if that would have been the extent of my problems, I would have been happy with. I started having about a year later, and I actually had put up with vision problems for a while. About, I'd say a year later, and I have documentation of this, I went to the eye doctor, and my vision changed, which it does to this day. Some days I have extremely good vision. Other days I have eyeglasses, and it drives my eye doctor crazy. He doesn't even want to see me anymore because he tries to prescribe vision glasses for me. But I noticed my vertical lines on my vision, like looking at a doorpost, would be wavy. My horizontal lines at times, especially my left eye, would be completely, it'd be almost to the point be being disorienting, you know. So I went in and they sent me in for tests, and what they come up with that I had, and at the time I wasn't the age I am now, they determined I had macular cyst, which is a step worse than cataracts. It's another level that they deal with. And I said, well, how do you get this? What's this caused from? And they said, well, we really don't know. Usually old age people get this, but we really don't know what causes this. So I went in, had an operation. I had macular cyst in both eyes. My right one is still in there. It's not that bad. The stage of the operation is that you can have extremely good outcome from it, or you can lose vision from it because they have to laser this cyst off, and the macular they're dealing with, it's just touch and go. So they did that on my left eye. They removed the macular cyst. They removed the cataracts in both eyes that I had after that. And what caused this? I was always after a reason. They had no explanation for this. And, the only good thing that I thank God I asked for was on when I was going back and they put a gas bubble in your eye, the surgery and everything. My vision came back, and on my last visit to the surgeon in St. Louis, Missouri, the young eye doctor, which was there doing removing the bandage and just doing the follow up work, took it off and they checked my vision and it was all good. And I asked him just in passing, and I'm so thankful I asked him. I said, you know, I'm so curious. I just would love to know what brought this on or what caused this. And this young surgeon looked at me and he said, you know, I said, we really don't know. He said, the only time I've ever seen this, and he said, we had a case, he said, last year with some cell tower workers. And one of the cell tower worker was up installing some microwave equipment, and they fired this thing up, not knowing this guy wasn't off the tower, and they had to remove macular cyst from this gentleman's eye. Now, when he told me this, I mean, it blew me away. It just, he looked at me and he said, what's the matter? And I said, you don't know what that means to me. The minute he mentioned microwave, I will tell you, it really set me back, because it was more documentation, possibly.
Yeah, and for those who haven't caught it, and correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, I go back to the horse incident with how you were describing, essentially, like it was put in a microwave kind of thing, and the gruesome scene there. Yes. To what you experienced, because you didn't really have me convinced there until that end, where you have that, yeah, that connection that kind of puts a through line to all of that, which is fascinating. Well, I'm not sure if you can answer this, and it's okay if you can't, but did Ted also, after that event and experience, did he have ongoing health issues? You mentioned the vomiting, but anything long-term? And if you can't answer that, I totally understand.
He had some health issues. I really don't believe any of them. They were ongoing before this incident. Believe me, and Ted and I talked about this. And of course, Ted gave me the discretion to speak about this if I wanted to, but he'd rather I didn't. And we didn't. And Ted had no health issues, I feel, except he got physically sick that night. I don't think he had any other residual health issues from this. I only try to draw conclusions that I was exposed a prior time to this time with Ted. And there's another incident I'll speak about when I was out with an individual, and I think we were exposed to radiation. But the one thing I just want to bring up in passing, that Ted rather that we didn't speak with us with the property owners. He didn't want to upset them or worry them as far as what happened. And then there's the aspect that we're out there on their property. Ted never wanted to worry them that there'd be any kind of, lawsuit, or we try to hold them responsible for this, which we never, Ted would have, that was a father's thing from Ted's mind, but Ted didn't want to approach this with the property owners for several reasons. Now, I will tell you, in hindsight, that was the wrong thing to do, because after Ted's passing, one of the property owners, which I will tell you, I'm in contact with almost at least once a month, sometimes twice a week, on ongoing things happening at Marley. After Ted's passing, I owed it to him, and I started small, and I spoke about my scalp issues and my hair, and the property owner shared with me. He said, well, Tom, that's nothing new. I've been to the doctor 3 times for my head. I couldn't touch. I had hair burn. And I said, really? I said, you never spoke about that with us. And the gentleman's name, I'll just call him John. I said, John, that, you never spoke about this. And he said, well, I went to the doctor. He said, it was usually after we seen this light beam sweeping or got close to us in the field. And he said, well, what did the doctor determine in your case it was? And he said, well, our local doctor, the old doctor, just called it. He said he'd seen it before. He called it touchy scalp. And he just told him it would go away. Now, had we shared this with the property owner, we could have formed a bond there, you know, but that it shows to always be completely honest and share everything with the property owner and data you have with the people involved, because you don't know what it could mean to them in the case. So that's just briefly touching on this. And it's just why it affected. Go ahead.
I was just going to say it's an amazing through line from the effects on animals to you, to the property owners, that there is that physical evidence that shows there's obviously something going on. Can I ask you about now present day? And I don't want to keep you obviously all day. We're at an hour now, and it's a fascinating conversation. But one of the things I want to make sure that I ask you is, are you still going out there? Obviously, and sadly, Ted has passed away, and I'm sure that probably puts a hindrance a little bit on the investigation. But is it still ongoing? Do you have other cameras out there? I mean, what's the present day status?
Yes, it's ongoing. I have been there just once since Ted's passing, and I would tell you, there's people who want to work with us. If it had not been for this virus in this area, the one property owner, he actually didn't believe in this virus. And it went from the point of not believing the virus was real to his neighbor, which was a great friend of his, passed away. They found out with the virus, and where he came to town, and he picked it up somewhere, they believe. They don't know where. After his friend passed away, everybody out there and the property owner's wife has health issues. Even their family, they don't leave the ranch anymore, their farmhouse. And their farmhouse is not adjoined to this acreage, which is Marley Woods. They live on another ranch, another small piece of property. They've gone, I think, a couple times now to town, and now it's starting to hit again in that area. But they even had family members just dropping groceries at the mailbox. They didn't allow anybody out there. And the property owner said, Tom, anytime you want to go out by yourself, you have free rein. You're welcome. But we'd rather nobody else is with you right now till this is over. So I respect their wishes completely. I don't want to be the one to push their, you know, buttons out there. And but it, the property owner, there was a spell. It's in a little bit of a lull now. But I will tell you that 2 months ago, the property owner was calling me every other day at 9 or 10 o'clock in the evening, telling me what the land, what the, they have an individual that lives out there and takes care of the property. And he calls them when things start happening. And the individual will not come out of his, there's a mobile home out there for the individual that keeps the property and tends the cattle, and which there's very little cattle anymore, just for their own personal uses. And they keep it low key. And in the barn scenario, they feed, they don't let it go out into the fields anymore. But there's so many dramatic things happening out there again. You know, we had reports, he told me, we had a veterinarian that was out there tending one of the nearby ranches, some cattle, when she experienced this flying creature. She was out working cattle, and the property owner went to bring her lunch, and her medical bag where she was working was all there. Her truck was gone, and she had seen something in the air. She took out chase in her pickup truck across the field and tried to take, she caught a couple pictures of it, which I got. I post on my Facebook page a couple of them sometimes. But I will tell you, the high strangeness has not decreased. It's increased, if anything, at times. And, you know, last winter, the property owner called and told me of a phenomena they'd never had. And I couldn't get out there at that. It was extremely bad part of the winter. But he found on the one pond near where the cattle are kept, it was very thin ice, a light snow on the ice. And he described what came down from the cattle onto this thin ice and left three-toed tracks, which he measured at 13 inches in diameter of a three-toed track that went across this pond and went out into the center of the pond and terminated, just came to an abrupt end in the pond on the light snow and this thin ice, which he told me, he said, Tom, there's no way. He said, it wouldn't have supported my foot. He said, if you laid a large rock on there, it would have broke through. He said, it makes no sense. How can you lay down a 13-inch three-toed track of considerable weight on this thin ice and not break through and then terminate in the middle of the pond? You know, there again, the only explanation for this stuff is it's dimensionally based. It's so much of this, when you see it, when it's dimensionally based, it's crossing over, depending what angle you are from where it crosses, it has a totally different look or appearance. And, you know, it's just the only thing that can explain so much of what we dealt with at Marley is this, what they come to believe and proved in other cases, that this is all dimensionally based. It's frequency driven. And it, you know, when this stuff comes across, it's as real and physical as you and I. And when it's not there, it's not there. And there's so many at Marley cryptid sightings. The only Bigfoot sighting in the county was near Marley. The white animal, which I know you're familiar with that case, the large white animal, polar bear / sloth type animal. We found 16-inch long white hairs. We had tracks. We got plaster cast. We poured. We've got the tracks. Ted sent in the hair to analysis. Some to Phyllis Budinger, which I know you know her. They did microscopy on some of the hairs. Another lab was so intrigued that we didn't have the money for DNA work. And back then, the early DNA was crude. But one of the labs was so intrigued, they furthered this down the chain in the lab, and they did a very crude DNA, and it came back as no known match. on this 16-inch long white hair, we pulled up barbed wire fences. So what does that? Now, do we believe there's a living, breeding population of these creatures out there? Of course we don't. And Ted knew there wasn't. But when they're there, you have to believe, no matter how crazy it sounds and for what aim, the witnesses, when they tell you what they've seen, and these are, believe me, hardened farmers, that they don't make this stuff up for fun or gain. But when this stuff is there for whatever reason, and, Ted come to believe sometimes, and people ask it, well, what could the reason for this possibly be? Why would this stuff? Ted came to believe a hypothesis that sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes this stuff is far. It's like we're the ones in the test lab and we're experimented on to see our reaction, how we'll react to this stuff, what we'll do. There's the element of fear, I will tell you, that is used a lot. It's to gain, to generate fear in the eyewitness testimonies of these people. And there is that element. So there you have in a nutshell of some of the high strangeness what we dealt with.
It's an amazing story, and I'm so glad that I brought you on today to at least touch upon it. Can I ask where do you go next? Can I ask that? I mean, what do you want to do at this point? Because obviously this phenomena, whatever it is still there. You can, bring in technology that's much different than the VHS that you had mentioned earlier. If you had your way, what would happen next?
Ted wanted to further. Ted was so far ahead of his time with technology that wasn't available at the time. He had envisioned things and dreamt up things and ways to do things. The technology wasn't there. Back in the early days, Ted was trying to duct tape cameras on remote controlled airplanes and helicopters, which, of course, now we didn't have any success with that. And he didn't, of course. Technology now with drones surpasses what he envisioned back then. Ted envisioned, besides just having a 24-hour presence there, he envisioned a network of trail cams that would go back to a computer that anyone could go to our website back then. We were trying to set up, but we didn't have internet connection out there at the time. But we were trying to set up some way of having security cameras online 24 hours a day to monitor these areas. Anybody could go to this website and see what was going on in Marley at any given time. Of course, now I would like at one point, if we get the funding, to complete Ted's work with cellular. Of course, now that we have cellular trail cams that are out there, you can hook up cellular, like a cell phone, and back to a main data point and distribute it however you wish. In areas where you don't even have cell phone connection, I've looked in. There's ways to do this now with sat phones.
Yeah.
It's extremely expensive. And that is kind of in its infancy right now to the general public. The military has it. But you could hook these cameras up, with a sat phone to your source. Where anywhere in the United States, you could turn on and, view what's going on this network, and it would alert you when these trail cams go off. And, Douglas Trumbull bought us some state-of-the-art back then solar-powered radio trail cams that it had a mile line of sight. You could get it at 3 miles, but, of course, in the woods and everything, line of sight drops down to a quarter of a mile sometimes, but you could turn on a trail cam and watch it, or it would alarm you if something set it off. But that was Ted's goal, to have the trail cam network. You could view anywhere, anytime, and would be recording this on a DVR. And of course, like I said, the if just the state of the technology back then, you know, with the drones, we didn't have the drone technology that's out there. And Ted always envisioned when we had the one light source that came on, which I think you've seen photos of, I know. The most dramatic photo that Ted ever got was this one light source on the wood, on the field, through the timber he took with a golden orange. You could see it through the timber, and there was, he actually cleaned that up with different programs to where you could, it all focus into a shield like object in the middle of this field, and he always envisioned flying one of these drones. If we'd have had at that time, right into the heart of this, from our point A at a line of sight into the, what he believed these things to be were portals. And he said at one time, he said, you should have smacked me if I ever said portal, but he said, that's what they were. But he envisioned flying this line of sight into the portal itself. Which we tried to get there manually by vehicle. And just a demonstration real quick that one night we seen one of these where this always took place, this one portal. And Ted and I got in my vehicle. We drove 70 mile an hour on a county road to it. We got up to the field. We knew where it should be. There was no light, no artifact of it. And the property owner was back on site one on the deck. And thank God, and this is the kind of things you always have to be observant. We were on radio communication with the property owner. And the property owner said, well, what do you guys see? And we said, well, we don't see anything. And I turned around my vehicle and he said, well, Tom, I see your brake light on right next to it. And I said, we can't see anything. And he said, well, you should be there. I can see your brake light right next to this portal or this light. So that's how directional these things can appear. Now, how do you explain that? And that's what drove Ted crazy over the years, and Marley, I will tell you. But there are other aspects that it's why Ted, so many people ask, why did Ted Phillips devote his rest of his life going out to Marleywood time after time? That's some of the things that drove Ted crazy. And along with, he thought there would be an event at Marley due to his past experiences, which he didn't share with the property owners from another case he was on. I will tell you that he said, after I'm gone, he said, I don't care, Tom, you can share it with him. But because he had felt at that time over the years, if it didn't happen, it wasn't going to. So he said, you can share this with him, whatever you like. And but that's what kept Ted going and so interested and always back to Marley Woods.
If you have a couple more minutes, I didn't mean to throw you off here by throwing this. Yeah. Is this the picture that you were talking about?
Yes, that is it. So that is absolutely it.
That's the one that Ted took of this light.
Yes.
Yeah. And the reason why I wanted to see if you had a couple more minutes is to explain some of these visuals. If you're okay doing that, would you mind?
That would be fine.
So
that would be great.
Yeah. Then let's just take a couple minutes. Hold on. Bear with me here because I've got an ability to. Let's start here. What are we looking at here?
That is the light source on the ground. Now, that is a light image that Ted took over the north field in Marley Woods. That's one of what he called the ambers. And I will tell you that picture doesn't do it justice. As you hear so often in ufology, that colorization it's on a spectrum that I believe that the eye can interpret, a camera very rarely can. Ted experimented with some film emulsions trying to capture that on film, and unfortunately he never could, but it's much more amber color with the naked eye than what you see there. You see a remnant of the amber, but that's what he referred to as the ambers at Marley.
I see. Okay, and then let's go. Let's do another one here. Let's see, these were some of the ones you sent over. What are we looking at here?
That was a time-lapse photo that Ted took of one of the, he set up against the, of course, the night sky, a time-lapse he took of one of the light bulbs and one of the ambers. And I will tell you that Ted had figured out with the time-lapse film that he did the calculations and he estimated that this thing was traveling in excess of 15,000 miles an hour. Now, the light bulbs can remain motionless. They can hover. They can zip around where you don't even you can't really even perceive them at times. And if you catch the little, at the end of this line, this image, you can see the little hook. It goes up and comes down. And that is one of the key features in it that Ted said is just, it doesn't apply to our physics because nothing can travel at in excess of 15,000 miles an hour and do that, you know. And but that's so common in ufology.
Is there a span of sky of the time lapse that you can kind of gauge for us? Like, are we talking about the entire sky? Are we talking about a 30-foot angle? What's the span here?
Yeah, it's the GPS on that I don't have. I would say you're looking at in the panorama of a night sky, you're talking about a third of the night sky if you're looking gotcha. Up in that time lapse photography there.
So that's a
under some magnification, I will add, and magnification, of course, adds some artifacts to it, but still the image is astounding. And then again, so much in ufology, if you look at that image, which to like the untrained eye, but to see gaps in that light. And yeah. That's the tract of a light ball in excess of 15,000 miles an hour, where you see gaps in it. Now, does that mean it stopped and started? You know, we don't know.
Gotcha. And I appreciate you staying over your time because some of these are pretty interesting. I want to just get to two more here, which ultimately may be connected. This is a casting, right, of one of the unknown animals.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a track we took of the animal. That was in a location where the property owner actually had claimed he shot, and this was a large white. And the guy works cattle. He can judge the weight of cattle. He said this creature was in excess of 300, 400 pounds. There you go. I got it now. Yeah, that's the track that we took. And it was in an area behind a barbed wire fence. And now this gets really strange again. He said he shot this animal at a good distance. He claims through the scope he's seen, he said he made it red, meaning he thought he hit it, he thought he seen blood. The animal at that point passed right through a 4-strand barbed wire fence. Now, I don't mean went over or under. He claims that it just turned and walked through this fence. Now, we found no blood at that site whatsoever. The strange part about this is, we did find the 16-inch long white hairs on the bottom strand and top strand of this fence. And I have images of Ted picking them off of this. Now, it makes no sense. It left physical tracks. It left hair on the fence. But the property owner swears it just passed right through this 4-strand barbed wire fence like it wasn't there. So...
Now, I put that...
It's impossible.
I put that image of the hair on the screen. I don't know if it's coming through on your end. Is this the hair that you referenced earlier in the interview that had no known match?
That's it.
That's it.
Yeah. And yeah, I don't have the image yet, but that white hair on that is the hair that we sent off, and Ted still has samples of that. you know, at some point we'd like to send for further DNA, mitochondrial in the upper, what they can do now is unbelievable. But yes, that's the hair, and came back under microscopy and a search. It came back, no known match. Now, we have 16-inch long white hair. There's no white ponies or dogs or anything in that area has 16-inch long white hair. But we got it from the sighting, the source of the sighting. It's physical trace evidence. You have to accept it, and it leaves tracks. And that track there, it's the size of my open hand. It would fit right virtually in my hand. It's that big.
Wow.
And stepping in that area, I will tell you, we didn't compress the soil. And Ted even did, in one case, he did a compression test on the soil. And he estimated it was pretty hard at that date. He said it looks to him like it did weigh around 300 pounds. So, and descriptions are from a white polar bear / sloth. Some compared it to a dare wolf. So what kind of cryptid this was, you know, we have no idea. And we think there's a living, breeding population of these things out there running around. We know there isn't. This was the only time ever seen in Marley Woods by the property owners, this creature, the one and only appearance. Now, I will say, after he thought he shot it, the next day his daughter was on that piece of property, and she claimed she'd seen two of them. Now, it's, but they've never been there. Now, that is, that is an image that the daughter took. She had a camera with her, very high magnification, and we tried to blow it up. She tried to zoom in on it. Very crude, very poor image. That is the only known image we have of the creature. And Ted used several types of filters to clean that up and send it off. And you really can't tell anything except that it's a very large mass, the body, the neck, and the... From what people that know what they're looking at, and one of the veterinarians out there we showed this to, said that the neck and the head structure in that crude image just doesn't look that it makes any sense. He, from his expertise, it just doesn't look like anything he could recognize or identify from the structure of the neck and the head on it. So... That's what we had to work with, imagery. That's all we had, and we're glad we had that. But that proves they were seeing something.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to end with this photo simply because it was there for me to grab, and I wanted to give everybody an idea. This is you and Ted Phillips standing side by side. There's no date on my end. What do you remember when this was taken?
That was taken probably early, I'd say 2006, early 2006. Yeah. Well, yeah, that was one of the, when I really got to be close with Ted out there and we formed a working relationship, and I was in a lot better shape then. Debbie and I were doing the MUFON dive team at that point for MUFON, you know, yeah, that was quite, that's the structure behind us there. The metal building you see is a two-story structure, which was our office, and which the property owners, I will tell you, have even put on the deed now to the property as the Ted Phillips Marley Wood Research Center. They've devoted the place to Ted. So that was really great when they did that. And, it gets so crazy, John, in this business, I can tell you. That is actually the only structure, part of the structure we would show. We had actually, it showed photos of our building. And believe me or not, there were people with a lot of time on their hands that got on GPS photos and Google Earth. And there was one individual that actually thinks he found Marley, and he zoomed in. How many hours he devoted to it to find our structure on Google Earth, I have no idea. but he actually found it on Google Earth.
Oh, wow.
So that's the only image we would show after that of the building.
and if it came through on your end, I have to ask, and it may mean absolutely nothing, but that skull back there that is mounted on the wall, I believe it's a skull.
Yeah.
Is there a story behind that?
No, there really isn't. The property owners were having fire. It is. And the old cabin, there again, I don't have a picture of it up because the cabin's next to the building. But I will tell you, they were avid deer hunters. And it goes into another story about a hunter out there was an avid bear hunter, went up north. And what happened to him and Marley, he would never come back to Marley, what he experienced. But the one in front of the cabin is just full of skulls, deer skulls. You name the type of critter, and it's hanging on that front of that log cabin. But it's not related.
Well, I got you. Well, I had to,
there again, skull, I will tell so you that. Ask.
Well, Tom, I thank you so much for spending so much time with me. I know we kind of scheduled an hour, and here we are an hour and a half. And that, you know, the photo show and tell there was a little bit impromptu. So I appreciate you playing ball with me on that, because I had the capability to bring it up. And so I thought I'd do that and have you explain what some of those photos are. But thank you so incredibly much. And I wish you all the best. I want to bring you back, though, and bring you back quickly, because we never even talked about another aspect of your work and Ted's work, which ties into the Moonshaft project. So I'm hoping that you had enough fun this hour and a half to come back and talk about that. So you are absolutely invited anytime you would like.
Well, I would love to do it, John. And I will tell you, as Ted always said, Moonshaft is the greatest story never told. And we're working with people to try to bring that out. And all I can say is I truly believe it's just short. It's a story of instrumentality that's self-maintaining over eons of time, that's sitting over in Slovakia in a cave, and it's there, believe me. And it's the greatest story never told. And I truly believe it. Ted's been there.
Yeah, and it is a fascinating story. I talked at length with Ted about it many years ago. And when you come back, we will definitely dive into that, because that is a fascinating topic as well. But Tom, thank you again. It's great to see you again, and stay safe out there. But thank you, and we'll definitely do that second show here soon.
Okay, John. Well, thank you, and I'd love to do it. And I just want to tell you, Ted had such an appreciation over the years working with you, and he really respected your work and you as a friend. And you were one of the few, believe me, that Ted could trust and love to work with. So I just want to thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate that. That means a lot to hear. And thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And with that said, again, thank you, Tom. And thank you all for listening and watching. Please, if you can, if you like these interviews, give the thumbs up. Make sure you subscribe to the channel. Turn the notifications on. That way you're made aware about interviews and videos just like this. So thanks again to Tom. I wish him all the best with his further research. He is somebody that I very much respect in this field and have for a long time, along with Ted Phillips and those that work with them on these projects. Thank you all again. This is John Greenwald Jr. signing off, and we'll see you next time.